From KCUR News, this is Casey Kearns, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. On this week's show, a new director at the Black Archives of Mid-America and a new direction.
My biggest goal is to bring the community back to the Black Archives and have the archives open for the community.
A longtime leader in mental health retires, and Missouri lawmakers consider asking school children for proof of citizenship.
My job, to be an advocate for the taxpayers and to watch out for the taxpayers' dollars and make sure that those dollars are being spent on Missourians and educating Missourians' children.
Plus, hear about a lifetime of fighting fires in Kansas City.
There's been a lot of bad fires. But the worst day, I think, wasn't a fire.
Listen up for Casey Kearns just after this hour's news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Kearns is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
The Black Archives of Mid-America recently completed renovations on a new exhibit and archive space and also welcomed a new executive director. This is good news for the beleaguered organization. Back in the 1970s, Horace Peterson began collecting artifacts, documents, and photographs that tell the story of the region's African-American community. The collection fell on hard times after Peterson died unexpectedly in 1992. But with help from the city and the public library, the Black Archives plans to open in its new home in June. Topeka-born Doretha Williams is the new executive director. She has a doctorate from KU in American Studies. Susan caught up with her at the new location in the 18th and Vine District.
My biggest goal is to bring the community back to the Black Archives and have the archives open for the community. Everywhere I go, someone talks about the Black Archives, their experiences. They worked with Horace Peterson or they worked on this collection, or young people who tell me, oh, when I was younger, I used to play in Aunt Lucy's Cabin. So there are people who want the archive to open and to provide that service, to provide that site of intellectual inquiry, of research, and public programming. So my biggest goal is to bring the community back and have this place open for patrons and those who want to do research, those who want to submit their collections or what have you. So that is the biggest goal right now.
So I'm curious, you're someone who's had a scholarly interest in a lot of these topical areas. Do you find yourself, even now as you're here, going through some of the stuff with great interest?
Yes, I do. And that causes a problem sometimes because I'm, you know, needing to be working here. But yeah, I get in the archives sometimes and get to digging through things and things that are really interesting. Plus, learning more about the Kansas City area has been, I guess, a real thrill for me right now. And when I was an undergrad, I worked for the Special Collections Library at Fisk University. And I remember, you know, having to be pushed to do my shelving because I was reading the books and looking at the archive there. That desire to look in the archives and kind of go through the material was really rooted in who I am at a very young age.
These various collections, what story do they begin to tell? What themes start to emerge about the Kansas City community?
The themes that emerge really include the vital entrepreneurship community here in Kansas City. We target the educational institutions like Lincoln School, different educational programs in the area, different histories of the Negro League, you know, African Americans in baseball, different ideas and themes about sports, and definitely we have the theme of music that comes out in the collection. So you have a narrative of African Americans, smaller in population, you know, related to other areas of the country, but a collection of African Americans searching for that full citizenship in what we call, you know, the West or the Central Plains. So you have that idea of developing communities, ingenuity, helping to grow and stabilize the Black community in this region.
What's currently here at Black Archives of Mid-America if people were to come down to see when it opens?
We have a collection of older African American literature that may or may not be in circulation anymore. And then we also have some items from a collection of the Buffalo Soldiers. When it opens in June, we'll have the permanent exhibit, and that's titled My Eyes No Longer Blind, which is a history in an exhibit of African Americans in Kansas City. Right now, the collection contains a lot of valuable pieces, history of Freedom Inc. We also have a lot of information and material on the call. We have collections of photographs from different people in the community, starting back, you know, in the early 20th century.
All of these materials were in danger just a few years ago. At that time, the archives were housed at the firehouse at 20th and Vine. The caretakers of the collection hadn't paid property taxes for several years, and Jackson County had sued. Then, failure to submit audits prompted the city council to stop giving the organization its subsidy. In yet another blow, the Missouri Secretary of State's office dissolved the archives as a nonprofit because it wasn't filing annual reports. The firehouse was finally closed in 2006, with the archives' contents inside. Many were concerned that the material, most of which is irreplaceable, was threatened by mold and mildew. But now, Doretha Williams says those concerns are behind them.
The collection is secure right now. It was due to the efforts of individuals really involved with the archive. Barbara Peterson, who is the widow of Horace Peterson, the founder, Sharon Sanders Brooks, individuals at the library, and individuals in the community came together and said, you know, we have to secure this collection. You know, it's priceless. And so that was when Governor Jay Nixon was the Attorney General, and he also helped to bring the community together to have a discussion of what are we going to do. And that's when it was decided to get the collection secure and to find a facility to house it in.
So there's a lot of pride in this new building. Can you describe a little bit about what it looks like now?
It's a large L-shaped building made of stone. It sits just north of the 18th and Vine District. It's a great facility. It used to be a Parks and Recs building, and the Parks and Recs and those who came through to renovate have done an excellent job. The Full Employment Council occupies one wing, and then the Black Archives operates in another. We have wood floors, great stonework, and I think the greatest thing about this building is that what was structurally sound, significant, and architecturally beautiful was preserved. So it's not like one of those buildings that have been completely overhauled and it's all white plaster. This is a beautiful building. The stonework is here. It used to be a stable as well, so we have some kind of cattle ties in the cement, in the mortar of the building, and that's always neat. We still have the fire doors. Great lighting, great windows, and it is also refurbished to be as green as possible.
And I know you probably weren't here yet, but from what you heard, was there thought given to how the design would suit the archive's purpose as they put this together?
The main concern was how to house the archive. So to make sure that there was a room that was large enough not only to house the current collection, but also to have room to grow, to take in additional collections. That was, I think, one of the biggest issues. And then to make sure there was a room, the exhibit hall room, that was large enough to hold a permanent exhibit, and to make sure there was space for classrooms and different public programming. So that was all taken into consideration.
Renovating the old Parks building cost over $5 million. Much of this was made possible by funds from the city. It wasn't complete, though, until the Kauffman Foundation awarded a $1 million grant to the Kansas City Public Library to finish the renovations.
The library also serves as a place to host our public events that we're going to be having. And those building managers at the public library have been great for me because they come and they do a lot of work in the building as well, and that's been great.
On the flip side of that, though, is there any concern about, with the library stepping in, that the African-American community loses control over an important asset? Of course, I've heard that from critics of that relationship.
I would say to that all relationships shift and move. And I don't believe it's the intention of the public library to take over or to have a power trip about the situation here. And, you know, we're in an economy that, you know, folks can't really just take over other people's stuff anyway these days. So I don't think that's an issue at all. But the relationship will move and fluctuate as the Black Archives continues to develop a permanent staff, its own situation when it comes to programming and financing. So it'll shift and move. I don't think that should be a concern of people who are, you know, have that type of worry.
I know you mentioned the Kauffman Foundation and others who donated to make this whole dream come true. There have been issues in the 18th and Vine area of museums having a hard time then maintaining their operational costs, their maintenance costs, and those sorts of things. What kind of plans are afoot for the archives to be able to stay solvent in terms of operation?
We're putting together fundraising proposals. Right now, we're also doing a lot of grant writing. We wrote a grant for the Missouri Humanities Council, and we received word late last week that we did get that grant, and that grant is for a teachers' institute, which will be held a week after our opening, June 20th through the 21st. And it's a grant, like I said, for the Missouri Humanities Council. Dr. Lonnie Bunch, who is the director of the Museum of African American History and Culture at the Smithsonian campus in D.C. He's coming to be a speaker for that event. We plan to have as many as 40 teachers to come in and listen to seminars and take part in workshops about teaching African American history, specifically the African American history of Kansas City, in their classrooms. So a lot of it is going out and fundraising, but also making sure we're creating public programming, because without programming, you can't really go and fight for funding. You have to show that you're doing something. And so having that grant under our belt right now is great, but we still have to do more footwork as far as grant writing and general fundraising for operational costs. We still have to do more of that.
So you mentioned at the top of the interview about your vision to really reconnect with the community. What kinds of mechanisms to connect with the community do you have in mind for the future?
We're targeting four really segments of the community at this time. We're targeting our educators through our workshops and teacher institutes. We're targeting our elders in our community through programs. We're having a program, hopefully in early March, titled Evening with the Elders, where we're going to be discussing and having question-and-answer period with some of the elder historians and storytellers here in Kansas City. So, and then also doing oral history recordings with the elders in our community so that we have their voice and we have their record of their lives. We're also connecting with our youth in the community, and that's when our youth programs are going to come into play, because we have to teach our youth that when they get older, they need to remain connected to the Black Archives, and not just Black Archives, but arts and humanities and education.
By the way, the Black Archives used to sponsor Juneteenth. Is that a tradition that will begin again, do you think, or is that on the back burner for right now?
That is actually not on the back burner. The opening, June 16th, will actually coincide with a Juneteenth celebration. And I've heard of the ones in the past. It may not be the grandiose ones, but we're going to get there eventually. But no, the Black Archives will definitely be working with others in the community, because there are other organizations who will be doing work on Juneteenth. And we want to collaborate with the entire district and the entire city to bring that back to its heyday.
That was Doretha Williams, the new executive director of the Black Archives of Mid-America, located in the historic 18th and Vine District. The archives will open to the public this coming June.
Coming up, lessons learned after a career in the mental health field in Kansas. An interview with David Wiebe, who just retired from Johnson County Mental Health. You're listening to Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
A Missouri Senate committee begins hearings this week on a bill that would require schools to check the immigration status of all students. And it calls on police to check on anyone they stop if they have the suspicion it could be an illegal immigrant. Sylvia talked to supporters and opponents of Senate Bill 590.
It's hard to say for sure how many illegal immigrants live in Missouri. The research organization Pew Hispanic Centers conducts national surveys and puts the number at anywhere between 35 and 75,000. That's about 1% or less of the population of the state of Missouri. State Senator Will Krause, who represents Lee's Summit, says his bill is about getting more precise information.
We're not trying to run people out of town. We're trying to get data.
Krause says that last year he sponsored a bill that would require the attorney general to sue the federal government for the costs of illegal immigration to Missouri taxpayers. For example, the cost of educating the undocumented, paying medical bills, and local law enforcement expenses for checking the status of and detaining immigrants. Some senators wondered whether these costs were really significant, so Krause tried to find out.
So we went out and tried to get information about the impact that illegals were costing on taxpayers, and no one was tracking any information. We couldn't get anything from schools. We couldn't get corrections isn't keeping anything. So that was the genesis of this bill, and we modified our other bill.
This bill requires schools to check birth certificates of students enrolling in the district at the same time as they check residency. The numbers, along with enrollment in English as a second language classes, will be compiled by the State Department of Education and sent to the state legislature. But the identity of the undocumented students will be kept confidential, and Senator Krause says it won't affect their education.
The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that those kids have a right to go to schools.
The bill also calls on state and local police to check the immigration status of the people they stop, quote, when practicable. This expands an existing state mandate to check status on arrests.
They have to have reasonable suspicion. They don't run everybody. They're running people that they believe are here illegally.
The bill states clearly that race, color, and national origin cannot be used as a way to identify people, to look into their immigration status. What would be reasonable suspicion? What would that be based on?
I'm not a police officer. I wouldn't know what the police officer would use for reasonable suspicion.
Those who oppose law enforcement getting involved in immigration say this will lead to racial profiling. Vanessa Crawford of Missouri Immigrants and Refugee Advocates says similar laws in states like Arizona are facing court battles.
Where we have seen in communities where local police are doing the job of immigration agents, it drives a wedge between the police and the community. And where the police and the community should be cooperating with each other, what we have is mistrust of the police.
The school section of Missouri Senate Bill 590 is similar to an Alabama immigration law passed last year. The part instructing schools to collect immigration status was enjoined by an appeals court. Crawford says while it was in effect, thousands of kids in Arizona didn't go to school.
The stakes are very high. Our immigration system separates families all the time. Parents get deported away from their children. Citizen children end up staying here, and a non-citizen parent gets sent away. And there's good reason for families to be cautious.
Crawford says the bill will end up costing a significant amount to implement, and even more if it's challenged in court. And she disputes the idea that illegal immigrants aren't paying taxes to support the services they receive from the state.
There's this idea that we're talking about, the problem of illegal immigration, or we're talking about dollars and cents. And the truth of it is that we're talking about real people and real families. We're talking about parents and their children and trying to, take care of your family and be safe.
State Senator Will Krause says there are too many unknowns when it comes to illegal immigration in the state of Missouri.
My job to be an advocate for the taxpayers and to watch out for the taxpayers' dollars and make sure that those dollars are being spent on Missourians and educating Missourians' children and taking care of the disabled in the state of Missouri. When we have a significant cost to people that are breaking our laws in the United States and the federal government continues to release these people and fail to do their job, that is impacting the services that we can provide to all Missourians.
Senate Bill 590 will have a first hearing before the General Laws Committee on Tuesday morning.
For four decades, David Wiebe has been at the forefront of mental health care in this region, helping shape the community mental health system that exists in Kansas today. As director of Johnson County Mental Health Center, for more than two decades, Wiebe has overseen its growth from a staff of 80 to one of 400. one that helps thousands of predominantly low-income people with mental illness live independently. Now at age 72, Wiebe is retiring. He recently sat down with KCUR's Alana Gordon and told her how his experiences early on as a KU social work student in the 60s had profound impact on his work in mental health.
My very first field placement assignment was at the Missouri State Psychiatric Hospital in St. Joseph, Missouri. And at that time, they had over 2,000 patients. And that really got me tuned into and aware of the needs of the mentally ill.
So this was a hospital that had 2,000 psychiatric patients in St. Joe.
In St. Joe at that time. And I met so many of the patients who had been there for 20, 30, 40 years or more, people who had been admitted as young adults or teenagers and were now in their 50s or 60s and had literally spent their entire lives in the state hospital. And that really opened my eyes in terms of the needs of people who are mentally ill.
Have you thought about that year since then very much?
Oh, I have. And I refer to that very often in terms of how fortunate I was in some ways to be in really on the ground floor of deinstitutionalization. And I had that experience in a very large psychiatric hospital. And then later in my career, basically seeing what was possible and being a part of creating a system of care that would make so many of those state hospital beds unnecessary.
What was a big moment of when things grew or changed in mental health services?
Oh, I would go back to mental health reform in 1990. I think that was truly a landmark piece of legislation and a major change in our system. And I think in the 4 or 5 years following the passage of the Mental Health Reform Act in Kansas, there was probably more growth and development, not only in Johnson County Mental Health Center, but in the mental health centers throughout the state.
You were on a government-appointed commission to look at how to develop a community mental health system in Kansas?
That would have been in the late 1980s, just before the passage of the Mental Health Reform Act in 1990.
What was the vision that you and others had then?
The governor at the time was Governor Mike Hayden, and he was very supportive of this whole move in terms of building up the community-based mental health system. I think there were a lot of other people involved, too, certainly. I know University of Kansas School of Social Welfare had done a lot of work in terms of identifying the issues and basically providing a perspective in terms of what the potential would be for moving more to a community-based system and away from an institutional system. I think one of the rewarding parts of my career was really being a part of that landmark effort that led to mental health reform and being a part of that group that helped identify and define what was important in terms of building this structure that then became mental health reform and established community mental health centers as the gatekeeper into the public mental health system, the gatekeeper into the state hospital system. I know there have been some other states that have closed a lot of state hospital beds and not invested nearly as heavily in their community mental health centers as happened in Kansas.
And so what do you see as being the most effective ways of supporting and serving people with mental illnesses in our community?
The whole aim of treatment is simply to enable and support people in living lives that are as normal as possible and facilitating some of the things that we take for granted, finding a place to live, figuring out how to manage your money, looking for a job, finding a job, building a social support network, doing our grocery shopping, just keeping our lives organized. That whole interface and the interaction between the criminal justice system and law enforcement and the mental health system has been one of the major developments, certainly looking back over the last 10 years. And when you think of how many people with mental illness end up in the criminal justice system, you realize what a huge challenge and task that is.
So how has that changed Johnson County Mental Health's role and the type of work that you do?
Well, in several ways. One of the things we've been very deeply involved in over the last 5 or 6 years is crisis intervention training, known as CIT training for police officers. And what this does is it gives officers the tools and the information they need in terms of how to deal successfully with somebody who is mentally ill, to know where the resources are that they can access to help people get to the right place if they're mentally ill, and to begin to provide options rather than simply arresting or booking somebody into jail. We have another very interesting initiative going on now. It's a pilot project with the Olathe Police Department, where a mental health center staff person works a shift at the Olathe Police Department and then responds as a co-responder with officers when they believe they may be dealing with a person who is mentally ill. And in the first 3 months of that project, this individual, the staff person, responded along with officers to 90 situations, only three of which resulted in being in bookings into jail. And I thought that was remarkable.
You've been at Johnson County Mental Health for 26 years.
Yes, for 26 years.
What do you see in store in the future?
Well, I think community mental health centers will continue and will probably always be the foundation of the public mental health system. We'll never go back to an institutional system. We know that. I think the challenge and the unknown is to what extent and how well they will be supported.
And so what type of situation, climate, and atmosphere are you leaving Johnson County Mental Health today?
Oh, I think without question, this probably has to be one of the most challenging times that we've faced. And it really is driven by the current economic environment. What we see is kind of that inverse relationship. As we have a difficult economic environment and as our funding resources are squeezed and we've lost significant money, especially in our state grants, and simultaneously we see a dramatic increase in the number of people who seek our services. For the last year or two, our intake staff have told me that we average probably 50 or 60 calls a week where the precipitating reason for the person contacting us was economic in nature. People who lost their jobs, lost their insurance, their home is being foreclosed, can't pay their bills, and that is the thing that really pushes them to contact the mental health center. And I think if you look across the state, I think we see the same kind of trend. And I haven't seen specific numbers, but there is no question in my mind that in terms of the number of staff, the workforce is undoubtedly smaller today in the Kansas Community Mental Health Center system than it was 3 or 4 years ago. No question about that. And at the same time, I can't help but think that the need is simultaneously increasing for services.
So is it a difficult time to leave?
Well, this is something that my wife and our family have been talking about for quite some time. You know, I'm 72 years old now, and at some point you simply have to make that decision to leave. And certainly when you look at the kind of climate that we're in and the economic environment, the challenges we have, and you think, I've been at this so long, now maybe now is a good time to get out. And then on the other hand, I think about, you know, maybe I should stay around and see this through because, you know, there's so much work to be done and there's so much need out there. And, you know, and I've basically been in this business because I believe in it. I believe in the services we provide. I believe in the consumers that we have. And I think it's been an important mission for me, certainly personally in my own life. And so in that sense, it's been kind of hard to step away from it.
David Wiebe, recently retired executive director of Johnson County Mental Health. Thanks for speaking with me.
Thanks. I've certainly enjoyed it.
Wiebe spoke to KCUR's Alana Gordon. If you can't listen to all of Casey Kearns today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes. Enough doctors in rural America. And in Missouri, while 40% of the population lives in rural areas, just 25% of the state's physicians practice there. And many of the poorest and most remote counties have high rates of health problems and older populations. They also have the lowest rates of doctors per capita. KBIA's Jacob Fenston reports for Harvest Public Media.
The doctor shortage is a national problem. By 2020, the country will be short more than 91,000 doctors, according to projections by the Association of American Medical Colleges. But rural America is ahead of the curve.
We have fewer primary care physicians for every rural resident than in the metropolitan areas, and that's a factor of almost half.
Mary Becker is with the Missouri Hospital Association, which tracks these shortages.
We have an older workforce, we have an older population, and we have this huge baby boom bubble that is going to require more care.
And starting in 2014, Obama's health reform law will add 500,000 Missourians to the health insurance rolls, stretching doctors even further. Staffing shortages are nothing new in Albany, Missouri, a small farm town just a few miles south of the Iowa border.
Life was very difficult for a while. Short staffing meant that people worked double shifts, long hours, long days.
Donna Walter is an administrator at the Northwest Medical Center in Albany.
Attracting people to this area was extremely difficult. We don't have any calling cards. We don't have a big lake or anything to attract people here.
Administrators decided rather than trying to lure urbanites, why not grow their own doctors and nurses, starting with local kids?
I started off in seventh grade as a candy striper, filing, taking papers back and forth.
Katie Dias, now she's a doctor here at the hospital in Albany. She just started in August.
My voice just comes and goes.
Well, have a seat up here and let me check you out really quick.
The hospital helped Dias with $60,000 of her medical school costs. In return, she agreed to practice here for the next 5 years.
How are you feeling otherwise?
I feel great otherwise.
It was about 20 years ago, hospital administrators here started growing their own staff. They've helped around 30 local kids with school costs, totaling close to $250,000. I asked Donna Walter if that's more expensive than hiring a professional recruiter.
No, it's not. It's less expensive. The schooling is less expensive than a recruiter.
And she says it's more effective. Katie Dias says she has no plans of leaving.
I love being in a rural setting. I love serving the people of this area.
But she's an exception. If you ask incoming med students, only 3% say they want to go into rural practice. Kathleen Quinn at the University of Missouri has studied why doctors choose rural.
It might be obvious, but the research shows that where you're from is the very most important thing that influences you to go back. You might have a rural identity. You grew up in a rural area. Your values are tied back to rural.
Quinn says her research supports the sort of grow-your-own approach Albany's taken. Find young people with that rural identity, get them interested in healthcare, and then train them to be doctors.
So again, where's the artery? Right, so you want to hear that artery, so we want to set that over the artery.
Dale Esmeyer is a family doctor here in Milan, Missouri, another small town in the northern part of the state. It's Saturday, and he's spending the day in the high school library, showing students how to take blood pressure.
Now you can pump it up.
Students here created this Health Careers Club earlier this year with help from the Northeast Missouri Area Health Education Center. Michelle Mollick is the group's executive director.
Kids in middle school start ruling out careers because they say, I can't do, I won't do math, I'm not good at this, I'm not good at that. So we start early because you have to inspire them first.
Back in the school library, Hannah Scott is trying on the blood pressure cuff. She's a senior here at Milan High. She says she already knows she wants to be a family doctor. And she wants to stay rural.
Yes, that is one of my main priorities. I really want to come back to a place like this or someplace close to my hometown because I love the small town feel and I just want to be around this place because I love it.
Getting students like Hannah interested in medicine is good for local hospitals and also for their patients, but it's also good for Hannah. For kids like her who want a professional career here in northern Missouri, there aren't a lot of options.
You know, obviously we have our processing plant. There also is swine farms.
Mark Forster is the high school principal in Milan. He says the vast majority of students move on after high school, and they don't look back.
Maybe 5% might stick around or may come back sometime during their adult life.
Like many small towns in northern Missouri, this one has been about the same size for the past 100 years, hovering just around 2,000 people. The local hospital is one of the biggest employers in the county with 110 staff. That's a big deal for a town this size. According to one study, every doctor working in a rural area generates $1.2 million in revenue every year. That economic activity means more shops and restaurants and better schools. That, in turn, attracts more professionals like doctors and nurses. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Jacob Fenston.
A longtime firefighter tells stories about the KCFD. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
In area news this week, Romeo Crennel won the job of Chiefs head coach. The Missouri Supreme Court looked at congressional redistricting plans. And Governor Sam Brownback's State of the State address was headlined by taxes and economic development. Steve Bell revisits those and other top stories of the week on KCUR's Weekend News Review.
Governor Sam Brownback proposed sweeping changes to Kansas tax laws.
I'm proposing a major step in overhauling our state tax code to make it fairer, flatter, and simpler.
Brownback would lower income taxes in the bottom bracket by 14% and in higher income brackets by around 30%. But the plan would also eliminate many deductions, including those for home mortgage interest and charitable deductions. He would also make the current sales tax increase permanent. House Democrat Paul Davis commented,
"My fear is that what Governor Brownback's tax plan is going to do is it's going to shift more of the tax burden onto working families while decreasing it for businesses in the most wealthy Kansans."
Brownback wouldn't use those words, but admits the goal is to stimulate the economy by leaving business owners more after-tax money. The governor also proposed a new school funding plan and a big program to boost vo-tech education. And he would restore about half of what he cut from the arts last year, kind of. Budget Director Steve Anderson says $200,000 would be available for arts programs, but only for ones that create economic development.
What we will ask for now is for them to provide an economic impact statement that shows that return, and we're willing to make that investment if, in fact, those numbers are good.
To that end, Brownback would merge the Arts and Film Commissions. Missouri Governor Jay Nixon doesn't give his State of the State speech until this coming Tuesday, but Republicans in the legislature were cranking out proposals he will disagree with. One would make it harder to sue for discriminatory firing. Another would make big cuts to the workers' comp program. Rich Aubuchon of the Missouri Chamber of Commerce testified for that one.
It would free up otherwise capital that is captured within the system for workers' compensation. It could be used for job creation.
Another bill that cleared committee would limit Missouri spending growth to inflation plus population growth. Still another would block Governor Nixon from creating a health insurance exchange. The Missouri Supreme Court heard arguments for and against the new congressional redistricting map. Jerry Griman argued for plaintiffs that are upset with the new boundaries of Emanuel Cleaver's district.
That's why the 5th District is so bad, because you take urban Jackson County and you join with them three largely rural counties that may have very little in common with them.
There will be no ruling for several weeks. A lot of players and fans got their way when Romeo Crennel won the job of head coach of the Kansas City Chiefs. General Manager Scott Pioli said, though, that it wasn't a popularity contest, that the team actually had played better under Crennel.
Well, I think the three games had a lot to do with where we arrived at this decision.
Crennel says he'll also continue to call the plays on the Chiefs' defense. Wrapping up the week, 14 people in a St. Joseph license office were indicted on charges of providing fraudulent documentation to about 3,500 undocumented aliens. And a Jackson County judge said any ruling on obligations and financial arrangements for 5 complaining districts and the now unaccredited Kansas City School District probably won't come till around the 1st of March. The Kansas City District says so far only about 50 students want to transfer out to neighboring districts. This is KCUR.
In the early evening of December 29th, Louis Scooter Martin was working the final hours of his last shift before retiring. For most people, that would mean eating a big sugary cake and hearing some words of tribute from the boss. But Martin spent his final hours racing through Midtown traffic toward one of the biggest fires in Westport history. That was at the Westport Presbyterian Church. It was a fitting end of the career of one of the longest-serving firefighters in Kansas City history. This week, Alex Smith visited Louis Scooter Martin at his home in Liberty.
He's less than 2 weeks into retirement, and Louis Martin still hasn't completely adjusted. In the big, bright living room of his suburban home, he's picking up toys after a recent visit from grandkids, but his mind still lingers on the career he's leaving behind.
There come a time I just figured it was time to quit. I'll miss it. I'm trying to miss it now, but it's time to go.
In 1960, Louis Martin was a 21-year-old Air Force veteran working as a typewriter repairman. He was out on a call when he saw a job listing that would change his life.
I was down at City Hall one day, and I just happened to look up there and saw they wanted to hire firefighters. And so I thought it might be interesting. That called me about 2 weeks later, and I've been there ever since.
After 30 days of training, he started at a station in downtown Kansas City, Missouri. That year, 1960, turned out to be a big one for major-scale fires, so Louis Martin's career got off to a quick start.
At this station I was at, 25, we ran all second and third alarm fires in the West Bottoms. And that winter, seemed like they had five or six big fires in the bottom, West Bottoms over there. So it wasn't long before we were right in the middle of some of those.
He was eventually moved to Westport, where he spent most of his career. From early on, Martin worked primarily as a driver. This was a long time before GPS, and drivers were required to have a near photographic memory of their districts.
The old captains there, before they'd let you drive, he would take you out and show you the streets, and through the days he'd question, where's this street at? And when he felt you knew your district good enough, well, then you'd get broke in to drive.
One of the hardest parts of being a firefighter is something you can't be trained for. Dealing with the physical and emotional demands of the job is something you can only gradually get used to. But the stress and pressure never really go away.
I don't know. You just unwind, I guess, and get clean. You get a shower, clean up, and sometimes you don't fall asleep. You just stay up all the rest of the time. It's stressful when you're doing something like that. You know, some mornings I'd come home and just lay down for a couple hours because I didn't rest the night before. And that's the way it goes.
The countless fires over many decades all tend to blend together. But the worst day is still very clear in Louis Martin's memory.
There's been a lot of bad fires, but the worst day, I think, wasn't a fire. It was when the six were killed out on 71 Highway on the explosion, because we knew we'd worked with every one of them. They just saw the fire and got close, and that ammonium nitrate is highly explosive, and they didn't know it was there. And we spent 10 days just going to funerals. And that was the one that stays in my mind. It wasn't a huge fire, because you go to a lot of big fires, but that one explosion was just devastating to everybody.
Continual training has always been part of a firefighter's life. But after the six firefighters were killed, Kansas City, Missouri took dramatic steps to update its methods, especially when dealing with chemical fires. Today, in addition to hazmat teams and new technology, the training for firefighters is dramatically different than it was when Louis Martin started.
When I come on, we went through a first aid, Boy Scout first aid book, and it was just bandages and things like that. Now, you're taught CPR. They've had a lot of saves with CPR, but that's a big part of any fire department is the medical side now.
The typical career of a firefighter is about 32 to 40 years. So with Louis Scooter Martin's 51-and-a-half-year career, he's probably the longest ever serving Kansas City, Missouri firefighter. He probably won't miss the heat and the soot and the smoke, but he says that's really not what being a firefighter is about.
You always miss the people. That's what the fire department is the people. You have to work as a team. You get somebody now and then that freelances, they're the ones that get hurt. They're the ones that they don't last very long. But each company works as a team, and you're looking out for each other that way. But you'll miss the people you work with.
Louis Scooter Martin has just retired from the Kansas City, Missouri Fire Department. He spoke to KC Current's Alex Smith. Schools across the country are grappling with how to deal with bullying. It's a problem that has provoked some teenagers to suicide. That's maybe why two area theaters for young people are staging plays about bullying this month. And in the case of a new play at Theater for Young America, they're specifically tackling bullying against the disabled, with a disabled actor in the cast. KCUR Steve Walker reports.
Gathered around tables covered with soft drinks and snacks, both sweet and salty, are the cast and crew of Theater for Young America's world premiere play, Bullybot the Robot and the Gang of Geeks. It's the first day of rehearsal, and director Valerie Mackey is working on the lines that introduce the concept of geekdom.
Let's take those last two lines again, because remember, she says a gang, and then you repeat a gang of geeks. When she says a gang, and then you guys go. So let's take it from Veronica's line. We still want to solve the world's problems.
We still want to solve the world's problems, but we don't want to be a club. We want to be a gang.
A gang of geeks.
That's right. That's good.
Artistic director Gene Mackey, who wrote the play, says TYA has addressed bullying for years, having performed The Toughest Kid in the World, both in theaters and area schools. He says that he wanted to take a new look at the topic and linked up with The Whole Person, a local organization dedicated to assisting the disabled by addressing such issues as public accommodations and independent living.
We got involved with a wonderful organization, The Whole Person, and they were particularly interested in the issue of bullying as it relates to people with disabilities. It's not the same, but it has many of the same topics. And the idea of robotics, which is very popular with young people right now. The problem with showing a play about bullying, if you show a bully character, how do you handle that character? And so we made it a robot who can be reprogrammed.
The Whole Person's executive director, David Robinson, who is hearing impaired, says he wanted to collaborate on the play to bring attention to how bullying against the disabled can fly under the radar.
Most of us who have disabilities have experienced some form of bullying, especially those of us who have had disabilities since we were very young and growing up with and going to school. People with disabilities are usually the target for a bully. I mean, they're the most vulnerable. People are not likely to step forward and stop the bullying. So we felt it was a natural fit.
Among the cast is actor Lori Sparks, who is both deaf, though she is an adept lip reader, and in a wheelchair as a result of cerebral palsy. Director Valerie Mackey explains Sparks' history with TYA and helps her answer questions about acting and the show.
She is a very talented young lady. She has a willingness to expose herself, her emotions on stage, just like any other actor. She did Charlotte's Web. She's usually done characters that her disability was not even a part of it. Like when she played a sheep, she was just a sheep. And it wasn't even addressed. She was just on stage as her character.
Have you always wanted to act?
I'll be on stage.
She's always found it joyous to be on stage. When people have said no to her, that this is not something you can do, where you use your voice and your body on stage, she found a way to use her voice and use her body.
That people can do this.
Deaf people can do this.
Meanwhile, the Coterie Theater is reviving Laurie Brooks' play, The Wrestling Season, where issues of bullying involve high school athletes and unfolds on a wrestling mat. Steve Walker, KCUR News.
The Coterie's The Wrestling Season runs through February 19th, and Theater for Young America's Bullybot, The Robot, and The Gang of Geeks runs through January 26th at the H&R Block City Stage at Union Station. Find out more at kcur.org. Just click on Arts and Culture.
Thanks for tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast. Find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Sylvia with assistant producer Alex Smith. Kayla Regan is our intern, and our theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.